Well, before I open with this short story, I do want to acknowledge that Donna's, you know, my wife Donna, her mom Martha and her husband Carl are here with us, and we're glad they're joining us today. And maybe as much for their sake as yours, I want to tell you that this little dialogue I'm going to tell you is totally fake. I made it up entirely. You'll know when you hear it, because it's not something I could possibly ever do, because as you know, there's not a defensive bone in my body. But if you could imagine me being a little defensive, you could imagine maybe a short interaction occurring between Donna and I that might sound something like this, where Donna might say, "Boy, it's tiring doing all this work at the house." And I would answer, "Oh, so you don't think I do anything here?" And Donna would say, "I didn't say that." And I would say, "No, you just wish that you had married a real handyman." And she says, "No, I just need you to care about the house more." To which I would say, "Well, if you cared as much about the church as your stuff, then..." Yes, you should be hissing. It's a funny thing about defensiveness. Seems like it almost always goes downhill. You know, it kind of starts sort of lightly, and the more that's said, the further down it goes and the worse that it gets. Well, when I was reading in John chapter 8, as I was reading it from my perspective, I think I found a very interesting conversation between Jesus and the Pharisees where they get really defensive about what Jesus says, and they end up in this downward spiraling kind of conversation where the words get tougher and kind of harder, and they get more and more mad at Jesus as they continue to interact with him. And I thought maybe I should just skip the chapter and move on to something else because it's kind of odd. But I decided to work with it anyway today. And I want to talk a little bit about getting defensive with Jesus. Now, I realize as you're listening and even as you're considering kind of what we can learn from this passage, it can apply at a variety of levels. Of course, in the actual dialogue and situation, it's people getting defensive with Jesus. They don't like what he's saying, and they get into this bantering and this very interesting interaction. But I know you can't help, when you're listening to this, also think about how maybe you get defensive with your spouse or your boss or a friend or, you know, anybody else. You're having a dialogue and you don't like what's being said or where it's going. Maybe you've even kind of experienced this as we talk about it, just attempting, or maybe not even trying, but you're perceived as a representative of Jesus, and so somebody gets really defensive with you about that. And so what I've done, rather than kind of follow the conversation as it happens, because it goes from verse 12 through 59, and we'd probably be here for the next hour or more, I decided to kind of break it out in a little different way, and I hope it works okay for you, but I'm sure it'll give you lots to think about one way or the other. And so in John chapter 8, verse 12, Jesus makes a statement that in some ways seems, I don't know, seems pretty tame, and he says he spoke to the Pharisees again, and this is what he said: "I'm the light of the world. Whoever follows me will have the light of life and will never walk in darkness." And on the surface, that sounds like a pretty nice, you know, awakening to reality. Well, they basically respond to him by saying, "You know what? Just because you say it so doesn't make it true," which is kind of a pretty typical response of ours. You know, just because you say it doesn't mean it's right. Michael, just because you say that it's going to be cold today doesn't mean it is. What backs you up on that? It isn't true because you say it. I was in San Antonio this last week for once a year in this time of the year, the senior pastors of the Vineyard churches in Texas, we get together for a retreat, and we were in San Antonio this time. And the Wednesday about noon when we were getting ready to leave, a couple of us went to lunch together first. And I don't even remember the restaurant, but we had a really great waiter. His name was Johnny. He was real enthusiastic. And he was convinced us that we should get the guacamole because he's going to make it at the table and it'll be good. So he brings all the stuff out. And then he tells us, you know, I make the best guacamole of anybody in this restaurant. And one of the other guys says, really, who says? And he says, I say. And we laughed just like you did because we know, well, just because you say it doesn't make it so. And that is exactly what the Pharisees said back to Jesus. Just because you say it doesn't make it so. And I'll bet you Jesus has heard that from lots of people over history. Just because you make that claim doesn't make it true or make it right. And what I've noticed in the defensive posture, of course, hypothetically, because I've never been there or experienced it, is it's amazing how an offer of help is heard as an accusation. So somebody like Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. And what we immediately think is, what, are you saying I'm in darkness? We don't see him trying to help. We see him criticizing us. And that happens in our marriages all the time, doesn't it? And so Jesus goes on and explains to them, well, I'm not the only one saying this. Actually, the Father is also saying that I'm telling the truth. And they respond with, well, where is your Father? Now, I suspect this isn't as innocent as it sounds, as like, you know, where is God in heaven? Because the reality is that the word out is that Jesus doesn't have a daddy, that he just has a mommy named Mary, and we don't know who his Father is. He may be illegitimate. And so I think they're actually throwing down a little bit here. You know, oh, so your Father agrees with you. That's a very good statement. Where is your Father anyway? And so Jesus begins talking more, and he tells them, he goes on and says, and you know, if you're able to hear the truth will set you free. And they respond, wait, we have never been anybody's slaves. What do you mean by saying we will be free? Immediately, see, they're hearing every word as a put down, a criticism, you know, some kind of accusation to them. And rather than hearing what he's saying, they're just responding back and trying to deny the whole thing. Well, then it gets really, really intense. You know, in the language of the Bible, maybe you don't see how bad this is, but they finally get fed up. And now it's no longer defending themselves, but they turn on the offensive. You know, it's like saying, well, if you cared about the church, you know as much, and you'll hiss me when I said that. They say, well, see, we know we're right. We said, you're a Samaritan and you have a demon. Now they're on the offensive. Not only do I not like what you're saying, but the truth is nobody should listen to you because you're one of those people that everybody knows is not right. And besides that, you have a demon in you. Now, I was trying to think, Samaritan, I've probably said this before, you know, people are always looking for ways. I think, I can't say the word, I have to just say it because I'm just not able to say it, but it's like using the N word on Jesus. Or maybe it's like calling somebody a terrorist, which right now is a pretty hot thing. Nobody wants to be known as one. In fact, I've told you before, when I was working in a college ministry, but it has happened even up to this day where some of my friends like to get in certain company and say out loud, oh, well, hi, this is Michael. He's Iranian. And they want to see kind of what kind of response people give. The first friends did that during the Iranian hostage crisis. Then I remember I was going to travel to the Middle East, and one of the guys in the church said, you know, you might want to think about getting a t-shirt made that says, I'm Italian, not a terrorist, just so people won't, you know, kind of have their eye on me. And, you know, we cringe and all, but, you know, there's a real prejudicial attitude in the world right now towards certain peoples. And that's essentially what they were saying. Who is the object of our greatest prejudice? Who can we say you are that would just discount you? Because what we want to do when we get defensive, we have to villainize a person. Or sometimes we even use the word, you demonize a person, make them evil. And then if you can make them evil, then we have no reason to listen to them. I remember when I first became a follower of Jesus. Now, I remember I grew up Roman Catholic, and I was at a concert. I think it was a Randy Stonehill concert. Most of you never heard of the name. And during the break, all these people enter into conversation, and here's the main conversation I hear. Now, you know the Pope's the Antichrist. I'm like, what? I mean, you know, I may have some issues with my Catholic heritage, but I'd never consider the Pope to be the Antichrist. Like, you know, when people get defensive, though, they villainize and demonize people. And so that's the best way to take care of the Pope. You know, give him a demon, then we don't have to listen to anything, you know, that he says. So that was their way out with Jesus. Let's just give him a demon and he's off. But, you know, when you're in that defensive mode, it just goes further. You know what the last thing it says at the end of this interaction in verse 59? And it's probably in your notes or up here. It says, then they picked up stones to throw at him. If you can't sort of discount them, if you can't then discredit them, if you can't villainize them, then get rid of them. If that's what it takes. And that's what they attempted to do. But it says they couldn't get him because it wasn't Jesus' time, so he managed to get off. So, you know, my basic point on that is it just seems to be the nature of defensiveness, including with God, that we end up just kind of digging ourselves into a deeper hole and getting more angry and more defensive in trying to discount what Jesus might be saying to us or asking from us as he begins to enter into our lives. Now, Jesus, in the course of this conversation, points out a few things that might be at the root of their defensiveness. You could probably think of many others, but in this conversation, one thing he says to them is, you know, essentially, you really don't know me. You think you do, but you really don't. And so your reaction to me is out of what you think, not out of what's really true about me. And he said in verse 19, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. And one of the things John has done in the gospel over and over again, and we keep running into it, he makes this absolute connection between Jesus and God the Father. And he says, if you say, I know God, but I want to have nothing to do with Jesus, he says, well, you probably don't really know God because, like, they go together. This is his Son. If you knew the Father, you'd say, I'd know a Palandra anywhere. You know, they just look so much alike. Or, I know God. I can tell right away just looking at you. You got brown eyes, dark skin, long nose. You must be Jesus. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking, please. But people often respond defensively to Jesus as he attempts to kind of get into their life out of what they think they know, but really isn't accurate. You know, I was just thinking of some of the things I've heard over the years. Yeah, but you're the guy, you send innocent people to hell. Or you allow the suffering of innocence. Or you create this unreasonable path to get to God. Or you are oppressive to women. Or you hate homosexuals. You know, all these ways to getting defensive with God, you know, we're discounting them. The problem is none of them are true. And we get defensive because we really don't know who he is. But we think we do. I remember when I was about 16 years old, I had to go to court for, they thought I did some criminal activity. And so I had to go meet a judge in court. Well, fortunately for me, it turned out, actually, I found out ahead of time what I did was not against the law, and that I would be okay when it all got done. And so sure enough, they basically dismissed the case when I got there. But I remember the judge trying to be helpful and said, you know, son, let me just give you some helpful advice here. If you keep doing the kinds of things that you're doing, things aren't going to turn out real well for you down the line here. But if you'll obey the laws and if you'll do the right things and do good things, your life is going to be a whole lot better. All over. And I immediately, I'm walking out, and stupid me, even in front of my parents, said, who's he think he is? Why does he think he knows what's right? You know, what does he know more than me to tell me what's the right way to live? I was 16, what can I say? See, we react defensively because we think we know, but the problem is we don't actually know what we think we know. And so we're really not able to hear. One of the other problems Jesus noted with the Pharisees is that they actually see from a very limited point of view. He put it in these terms, verse 23, he said, you belong to this world here below, but I come from above. You're from this world, but I am not from this world. And one way that I look at that is essentially saying, you know, you guys have such a very kind of close up view of things. Like it's right in front of your face and you look and you think you see the whole picture. Well, I actually come from above. I mean, that is my orientation. It's where I come from. I see everything from above. You just see things from below. And you know, you don't get nearly as good a look looking up from underneath as you do looking down and seeing the whole thing. You know, I can imagine when we're walking our one-year-old granddaughter in a crowd of adults, you know, she may be thinking, boy, adults are funny looking. They just got these knees, you know, and that's what they are. But of course, we can see much better from above. And God's saying, look, it's like, you know, you see the trees, but you're missing the forest. They don't just stand alone. They make up something much larger. And I can see that. And you can't, and that's why you're reacting to me. Another thing he tells them in verse 37, he says, yeah, I do know you're Abraham's descendants, yet you're ready to kill me because you have no room for my word. And I think sometimes what happens to us is we so figure out a way of understanding the world and our lives and God, we create this neat little perspective and system that we see everything through and try to make it all fit in, that when we hear something that's contrary, we can't afford to be open to it because it messes with us. It messes with the way we think. You know, when I was first, really first honestly seeking for truth, I was absolutely not open in any way to the possibility that truth could be found in the person of Jesus. I thought it's more likely to find it in Buddhism or Hinduism or existentialism or in transcendental meditation or in radical politics. Surely there's more truth there. Because I had come to believe certain things and there just was no room in my thinking for this kind of God who may have revealed himself in Jesus. And that's where the Pharisees got stuck. And then when somebody says things that kind of challenges that, we immediately begin to push back. Or we tell them they have demons and, you know, we leave it at that. And the last thing I wanted to point out here, and I kind of understand why they then started getting more defensive, the more Jesus would say and try to help them understand their current defensiveness, they would just get more mad. And I'm putting it in a nice way, and I'll read how Jesus said it. Essentially, one of their problems is they had bought into a lie. They thought it was true, but it was actually a lie. And Jesus said it like this in verse 44. These are probably the harshest things he's ever said to anybody, even more than saying you're like a whitewashed sepulcher, you know, full of dead bones on the inside. That's pretty hard too. But he said, you're the children of your father, the devil. And you want to follow your father's desires. This was his response to them saying he had a demon. From the very beginning, he was a murderer and has never been on the side of truth because there is no truth in him. When he tells a lie, he's only doing what is natural to him because he is a liar and the father of all lies. See, the problem, and you guys don't even realize it, you know, see, they're trying to say, why would Jesus say the things he is? Where's he really coming from? And he's saying, guys, what you're saying is not coming from God. It's actually coming out of a false system. Now, you know, in Jesus' day, people didn't have trouble believing there was a devil and that he's real. I don't have trouble believing that either. You know, some of you may think, I mean, come on, you tell me, like, the devil's teaching me things? Or that just sounds pretty absurd to you. Well, yeah, that's kind of what he's saying. But if you can understand it this way, for sure, he's saying, you know what? The very foundation of your understanding of things is flawed. It's not true. And if you start from a lie, if you start from something that's false, then everything you build on it is also going to be false. And so when you hear the truth, you actually cannot hear it as truth, because you think the lie you're believing is actually the truth. And that makes us really defensive. I remember my very early days as a follower of Jesus. I abandoned all my other things that I attempted to find, you know, like the truth, and one of them being transcendental meditation. And so at my university campus, they were having a meeting for people interested. Y'all know what transcendental meditation is? Have you ever, raise your hand if you've ever heard of transcendental meditation. Okay, most of you have. They were telling us it's a scientific way of relaxation. Well, I went through their program and I had to bring an offering, and then they pulled out the Vedic scriptures, which are the Hindu scriptures, and they prayed these prayers, and then the Maharishi, somebody from way back, gave them this sound that was, for me, uniquely, well, actually, I found out later, most of my friends had the same sound. Well, I wasn't all that unique in the universe after all. So I decided I'm going to go to one of these meetings. And there's an auditorium about as big as this. And unfortunately, the only available seats were in the front row. Nobody likes sitting in the front row, not even in church, you know. So I got in the front row. And then when the question answer time came, I said, well, I have a question. And then I decided to turn around and face everybody else and told them my experience with TM and why I didn't think it was true and where the truth was. And believe me, I got some real defensive reaction, especially from the teacher whose meeting I just took over. It was only for a couple minutes, but you know, we just cannot hear what's true when we think the lie that we're believing is true. And it's just one of the difficulties that makes us defensive. And unfortunately, defensiveness costs us a lot. And I bet you can think of all kind of things that it costs you. I'll bet you some of you guys slept in a different room some nights because of your defensiveness. It cost you. Well, but we're not here to talk about husbands and wives, are we? One of the problems is when you're defensive, you just cannot hear. It basically closes your mind and your ability to hear. And that's because we cannot bear to hear the truth. In fact, that's what Jesus said to them in verse 43. He said, why do you not understand what I'm saying? And then he answered his own question. He said, it's because you cannot bear to listen to my message. It messes with us in so many ways that we cannot bear to hear it. It makes us angry. It frustrates us, and we get really defensive, and so we just cannot listen. In fact, it reminded me in the book of Acts, chapter 7, at the very end, they had brought Stephen before the council because they had heard he was saying things that were offensive to the temple and to the law of Moses, and so they wanted to get an account, you know, of what he said. And so it's probably the longest monologue in the Bible. And he just goes and begins to explain all the things that were wrong. and why they've always been defensive and kind of miss what God was saying. And here's what happens. It says at the very end of this, verse 57 and 58, with a loud cry, the council members covered their ears with their hands. Then they all rushed at him at once, threw him out of the city, and stoned him. And have you ever joked around, somebody's telling you something you don't want to hear, and you go, la, 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 la. You're trying as hard as you can to make sure that you don't hear what's being said. Even if you have to close your ears, talk real loud. You know, it's like being in a dark room when you get afraid. You know, you have to talk so that you sort of drown out those other noises that are scaring the heck out of you. And a lot of times when Jesus begins to come into our lives or press into our lives, it makes us afraid, and we react and get really defensive with him. You know, he says if we can't hear, we're going to end up dying in our sins. He told them in verse 24, that's why I told you that you'll die in your sins. You know, let me just read the rest of it. And you will die in your sins if you do not believe that I am. That I am who I am. And it's not that he's trying to look for opportunities to like make judgments on people. This is what happens when you can't hear the one who's trying to help you out of the condition that you're in. There is no way for you to get free from these things that are producing death in your life. And I thought, it's not, when you hear Jesus say, you know, unless you believe, you know, that I am who I say I am, he's not saying that, see, it's really a matter of belief. That's the most important thing, what you believe. And therefore, I'm measuring your belief, you know. Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? Yes. Okay, you got it. If you don't believe who he says he is, you will not trust him to help you in the way he wants to help you. That's really the issue here. God is not measuring, you know, okay, you got 5 right. All right, Chris, because you just had your birthday, you only need 5 out of 10, and you're good with God. He's shaking his head. How old are you, Chris? 30. Happy birthday, Chris. It really is his birthday. God's not measuring, you know, how many beliefs we got right. He's looking for us to understand and believe so that we can open ourselves to what he's trying to do in our lives. Because the other thing he says to them, if you can't hear me, you're going to end up staying in the slavery that you find yourself in. And I'm wanting to get you out of it. Verse 34, he said, Jesus said to them, I'm telling you the truth. Everyone who sins is a slave of sin. Now, I know I don't want to hear that either, but it's a reality he's trying to define for us so that we can get help from him and get free from it. It's probably why, of course, we won't ask for a show of hands because some of you don't want anybody to know. It's probably why at least half of our church has gone through Living Waters. Because you have found that doing bad things and wrong things and things that aren't actually true bring bondage into your life, and they end up enslaving you in various ways, whether it's emotionally, relationally, and you want to be free from that. But until you can hear Jesus saying, I want to help you with that, and you just don't react negatively, well, I don't need your help. You know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm as good as everybody else. That's a bad thing to say because everybody else is as bad as you. So that's not too helpful. It costs us so much to be defensive. On the other hand, openness rewards us. And let me close with just saying a couple things there. If we're open, it rewards us with a path to follow. Remember what this whole thing started out with Jesus saying in verse 12 of John 8, I'm the light of the world. Now, that wasn't just a bragging statement. Whoever follows me will have the light of life and will never walk in darkness. I can show you a way to live and a way to walk that gets you where you want to go. Probably 99.9% of all people in the world don't want to end up in bondage and slavery and death and heartache and broken relationships and pain. No, we all want to end up in a place that's healthy, that's whole, that's happy, that's meaningful, where our lives have significance, where we're making a difference for other people and for our world. That's the life we dream of, and we're all looking for some path that will kind of get that for us. And Jesus is saying, I am the light of the world. If you can be open, I can show you a path that you will really like being on. And that will absolutely change your life and give you, you know, fundamentally the things that you're really desiring. And he's wanting to cheer us on that. You know, this morning was, I had an awesome time being out here cheering the marathon runners. Now, you know, I like to be a little cool. I do have a motorcycle and a black leather jacket, you know. And standing on a street corner yelling at thousands of people is not my idea of cool. You know, a sign it, go runners. You know, to me, that sounds lame, but I had one, actually. It's like, what do you say? All right, yay. But I had an awesome time this morning. In fact, I'll tell you the truth. Part of it I know is my emotional makeup. I wanted to cry. I wanted to cry half the time. I felt a little embarrassed. I was hoping I didn't actually break out in tears. Now that would not be cool at all. But as I, see, I want to cry now too. But as you watch people come by and we're looking for their name, you know, and hollering, go Michael, and there are lots of Michaels out there, believe me. Go Teresa, and you realize, you know, these people came here today with lots of hope and expectation. They have worked tremendously hard. They have suffered just to be able to have a chance at, you know, really completing this, to run this long. And we are out there speaking words of encouragement to them to remind them that this hope is worthy. It's worthy. That there is reason to hope. That we think what they're doing is amazing and we want them to reach the end. And I could just hear Jesus. I could hear him speaking to me. This is what he desires. He is so excited for us that he just wants us to be able to reach the end of a path that will result in the greatest satisfaction that's possible, that we really will win the prize and not just end up on some dead-end street where there's nothing that we've pursued all of our life. And he gives us a path that he'll cheer us on. He is not interested in knocking you down, knocking you out. Oh, you need water? You know. Man, Jesus will put the band out there for you to play, to encourage you. He carries signs. Go, Michael. Go, Mireia. You know, he's out there saying all those things that sound stupid to us. Man, there's a lot of rewards if we could just be open to what's really going on. There's freedom. You know, and many of you know this verse 36, if the Son sets you free, then you are free indeed. And today's English version says, then you are really free. You know anybody that doesn't want freedom? If they don't, you know they're really twisted. People want freedom. And Jesus said, if you could be open, get over your defensiveness, stop reacting to me, and here you'll realize I can make you free. And finally, if you're open, he says, the reward is the life that I'll give you. It is eternal. That's pretty good. I remember, and it took him years again to kind of come back to Jesus, but when my brother John, the youngest, he was 12 years old, I become a follower of Jesus, so I was talking to him about, you know, Jesus and life with Jesus, and he decided, I want that. I want that too. Well, I remember we're in his bedroom, we're talking, and in the conversation, I mentioned heaven, and he's going, what? You know, I actually go to heaven too? There's a heaven? I get eternal life. Yeah, didn't you know that? This life that we enter into actually lasts forever. This is a whole lot better than what I was hearing when I was in high school. I remember listening to this record. It was Timothy Leary saying, you can be anything this time around. Well, you know what? This time around is pretty short. Jesus is saying, you can be what I've always created you to be forever, not just this time around. This is a pretty awesome reward if we could just manage to lay aside our defensiveness and be open to him long enough to hear what's actually being said and to see what is actually there. So, how about if I ask the prayer team to come on up?